This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because this is our time of day to go all across the state of North Dakota and celebrate the fact that we've got these wonderful main streets where people meet each other and talk about what's on their minds. And maybe for the last few months, some people have been talking about sports betting because in the middle of May, the Supreme Court made a very important decision that overturned a federal law that went back to 1992. Joining us to talk about this, Catherine Rand. She's the dean of UND's law school. Thanks for being with us, Catherine.
Thank you.
And Stephen Light, the dean of UND's College of Business and Public Administration. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Catherine and Stephen are co-directors of the Institute for the Study of Tribal Gaming Law and Policy. We'll get into that in just a moment. But Catherine, first of all, give us a background around that Supreme Court decision that took place on May 14th.
Sure. The case is Murphy versus NCAA. And in the court's decision, the court struck down a federal law called the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, or PASPA. And what PASPA did was prohibit states from authorizing or legalizing sports betting within their borders. The Supreme Court said that that was unconstitutional, that the federal government could not impinge on state sovereignty in that way, so it struck down the law.
So things are pretty much wide open for states to come up with new laws, I take it.
Right, exactly. Without that prohibition in place, now states can authorize sports betting within their borders.
Stephen, give us a sense of the size of legal and, for that matter, illegal betting across the United States.
Sure, and I think it starts with each of us thinking about, do we participate in some way? So for those of us who've ever put down a bet in your local office pool on the NCAA's March Madness when that rolls around each March with the college basketball tournament. If you bet even with your coworkers, you might have participated in sports betting in some way. And I got news for you. Not that the cops would be coming, but you might be participating in something either legal or illegal. So last year for March Madness, the American Gaming Association estimated that some $10 billion was wagered just on the NCAA tournament, and that something around 24 million people participated in bracket pools, and also that about a quarter of all adults in the United States, 54 million people, participated in some sort of betting pool. So we're talking about a lot of participation there. If you've ever bet on the Super Bowl, in the last year, the estimate was that about $5 billion was wagered on Super Bowl 52. And so that's betting a large percentage of it is actually illegal. So we don't really know the size and scope as of today of illegal sports betting, but the estimates are somewhere between $50 and $150 billion wagered each year illegally.
Well, until that Supreme Court decision in May, the place where you could go and legally bet on sporting events was Nevada, and in Las Vegas, a good chunk of every casino had a big set of monitors and boards that had the odds on everything that was being played that day. So it was certainly big business in Vegas. Catherine and Stephen, when you learned of the Supreme Court decision, what issues came to mind to you?
Sure. One of the most important issues would be how rapidly would sports betting expand among the states? And that depended on where states were in terms of their law and policy. So you mentioned that sports betting was already legal in Nevada, but today, just a couple of months after the court's decision, you can place sports bets in New Jersey and Delaware as well. And by the end of the year, Mississippi, West Virginia, Rhode Island are scheduled to be on task. And beyond that, the next likely states are Pennsylvania and New York. And 18 more states have introduced and considered legislation. So there's likely another wave of legalization in 2019.
How about North Dakota?
So North Dakota, I think, probably falls in the other half of states that are taking a more cautious approach, waiting to see, for example, how sports betting performs in some of those states, And also waiting to see whether there might be a federal law that comes in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision.
Well, Stephen, the idea of sports betting, of course, raises the idea of taxation, too. You know, some states, I assume, would be taxing betting, so this might potentially be another revenue stream for those states.
Absolutely. And that's what we've seen with the tremendous spread of legalized gambling generally over the last 4 decades to 5 decades. Gambling's really become ubiquitous in many ways. It's a presence in 48 states. As we said, there's a massive illegal market. There's also a massive legal market, about $32 billion in tribal casinos alone across the United States last year, roughly $5 to $6 billion on the Las Vegas Strip. When you look at the advent of big money, you look at regulation, and with regulation, you also look at taxation, as you mentioned, and states increasingly have become reliant on those kinds of revenue streams. And here, I think their eyes are wide open to the possibilities to collect additional tax revenue.
Well, what about the sports teams, the athletes?
Well, you raise an interesting question. So for the athletes, aside from the desire to compete, one of the biggest questions for the athletes themselves, for teams, for sports owners, and for the leagues is the preservation of the integrity of the game itself. So one major concern that arises with the advent of widespread legalized sports betting is whether there are any possibilities for undue influence that might occur. The sports teams and sports leagues are well aware of that. Everyone is looking right now at the question of how to regulate in ways that maintain the integrity of the game and also preserve what we all enjoy most about sports, which is the thrill of competition and the fact that we all believe that the outcomes are not predetermined.
So you don't think that the NFL or Major League Baseball is interested in some piece of that revenue?
Oh, most definitely. One of the key shifts that may not directly have generated the Supreme Court decision, but certainly played a role, was an attitudinal shift, both in terms of the public, as we've just mentioned, but also in terms of the leagues themselves. So actually, if you look back at 2012, all five of the largest sports leagues were advocating, in fact, they sued to prevent New Jersey from legalized sports betting. More recently, Commissioner Adam Silver of the NBA has come out in favor of it. The PGA, Pro Golf, Major League Baseball, several other industries, several other leagues have also come out in favor of the legalization of sports betting. And after the Supreme Court decision, they're most definitely looking to cash in.
Well, how about collegiate sports, the NCAA?
Good question. They're one of the leagues that is still just monitoring what's going to happen. I think waiting to see whether there will be an introduction of federal legislation. Both the NFL and the NBA are pushing for Congress to pass a law with uniform regulation, again, to preserve integrity. So I think there are a few leagues that are taking a back seat and letting other leagues lead the way.
Okay. Who are the likely winners of this decision?
Well, I think the states that were chomping at the bit to legalize sports betting are very, very excited. You mentioned tax revenue, and of course, that is the number one reason why a state would want to legalize sports betting within its borders. Pennsylvania, for example, their sports betting law charges $10 million for a license fee and places a 36% tax rate on operators. The other reason that a state might want to legalize sports betting is to support its existing commercial gaming industry. New Jersey was on the forefront of this. New Jersey is trying to save Atlantic City. That's why they've been pushing for legalization of both online gaming and sports betting.
How about the losers here?
Well, I don't know that there will be losers, because I think Americans' attitudes have shifted significantly. But there are many reasons why a state would not want to jump on this bandwagon and legalize sports betting. One could be the risk of undermining its existing gambling industry, right? And that might be what you're alluding to, that where a state has a gambling industry, whether it's charitable gambling, racetracks, or tribal gaming, that it doesn't want to increase competition for that industry within its borders. It might not want to jump on the sports betting bandwagon. And of course, some states are not all in on legalized gambling, most notably perhaps Utah.
Well, North Dakota and Minnesota have tribal state gaming compacts. Do you expect any of this to be reworked because of this change in federal law?
That's what we're seeing unfolding across the country in states with tribal gaming. Both the tribes and the states are examining those compacts, looking to see what the possible implications would be if the state legalized sports betting. In some of those states, the tribes and the states might be working together to figure out if there's a win-win approach.
Okay. You mentioned this tectonic change in public opinion, Stephen. We've had a number of these kinds of things. We have same-sex marriage. We have recreational marijuana is coming across the country now. Is this sort of a, if you will, for lack of a better word, a liberalization of the way we look at these things that used to be, you know, sort of vices, if you will?
Broadly speaking, yes. And actually, you used a key term, which is vice. And so those certain kinds of activities that historically, attitudinally, and or even with some opinions rooted in things like religious faith and so on, those found their way into public policy in particular ways and governed how we regulate issues, issues that are often seen as having a moral dimension to them. Here, over the last 4 or 5 decades, largely speaking, gambling has moved from a vice into being seen more as a virtue, something that has potential positive impacts on state coffers, but more importantly, isn't something seen as widely as being a negative for individuals. And actually, last year, there was a Washington Post poll that showed that 55% of individuals were in favor of sports betting. That's a complete flip from just a couple of decades ago when that federal law was passed, when PASPA was passed. At that time, a poll showed that 56% were opposed. So lots of change in public opinion, lots of change in activity, lots of change in technology, by the way, which is a really interesting dimension to this as well.
Catherine, from a constitutional law perspective, this looks like, as you mentioned earlier, states' rights prevails.
Absolutely. But it's important to note that there's another federal law out there, the Wire Act, that still would prohibit someone who lives in one state, let's say North Dakota, from using the phone or the computer to place a bet in another state like Nevada.
Hmm. So do you expect any congressional action on that, or is that going to keep it within the borders of every state?
It's interesting you should say that. There is a short part of the Supreme Court's opinion which seems to suggest that the Wire Act may not be as broad as it has been assumed for decades. So that could be an invitation for Congress to look at whether it makes sense for the Wire Act to continue to prohibit wagering across state borders.
Yes. If you've got apps and online come-ons or whatever, the phone or any other sort of wired connection by legal description becomes a bit moot, it seems.
Right.
Okay. So what is next, do you think, in the sort of the spread of gaming, the enabling of this particular enterprise to come out of the shadows and to become basically part of the United States' big businesses?
Well, Catherine mentioned already the types of states that are considering getting in the game early, and actually New Jersey obviously was a player right away. There were some stats that just came out yesterday indicating that in the first couple of months, the first couple of weeks alone after New Jersey legalized this, it generated some $16 million in revenue. So the first dimension is which are the states that are going to continue to be the early adopters, and how do they occupy the field? If you think about an industry like related to technology, you think about Facebook or Google or Netflix, it's always those first movers who occupy a new industry who become the ones who are most entrenched and most difficult to displace. The second thing that we're going to be seeing is the use of technology. I mentioned that before. What the casino industry is looking to do and what the leagues are looking to do is capitalize on the fact that millennials and younger, so Gen Z, those folks just are not as interested in entering a conventional sports book or bricks and mortar casino or even a conventional restaurant as older generations. So they're trying to capture that market right away. And you mentioned an app, you know, so imagine a situation where you're able to click on an app. You'll be able to use your phone to lay down a few bucks on who's going to win tonight's baseball game or the British Open this weekend. Or you might even have a chance to bet in-game on the over-under for LeBron James to drop 20 points in the third quarter against the Warriors right in that game. So that's, you know, those are the possibilities in terms of the spread. It isn't just about the legalization. It's about the diffusion of technology.
And about the potential for hacking, I guess, as well. There are winners and losers in gambling, and obviously the house is generally a winner. The state would be a winner if it's taxed. Losers can really lose a lot, and this is where gambling addiction raises its head. Is there any move afoot in all of this discussion about expanding gaming to, you know, also expand the services that deal with the problems gaming creates?
That's an excellent point. And I'd expect that the leagues and the states that are moving forward with legalization would be thinking about that first and foremost as well. With tribal gaming, we see services and funding for those services often written into the tribal state compacts. And that was an innovation that came with tribal gaming that we're seeing now spread into other forms of commercial gambling. So I think some of that attention and thinking right at the outset, how will a state fund those services for its people and its communities will be part of the conversation.
Well, as I mentioned, Catherine Rand, Stephen Light are both deans at UND, Catherine of the Law School, Stephen of the College of Business and Public Administration. But you are co-directors of the Institute for the Study of Tribal Gaming Law and Policy. So let me just ask you in closing, what are you most interested in studying right now about tribal gaming law and policy in light of what's happened this year?
Well, of course, we're interested in thinking about the intersection of sports betting and tribal gaming and thinking about what are the factors that would influence a tribe in being an early adopter in the sports betting sphere and what are the factors that would make a tribe sit back and take a more cautious approach. We're also interested in looking at trends in tribal state compacts, which overlaps with sports betting, and we're very much looking forward to continuing that work together.
Yeah, and it also out there is the question of how gaming, as it continues to change, alters the playing field for intergovernmental relations, for the relationship between tribal governments and state governments and localities, and the kinds of populations and communities that may benefit or may not benefit from the spread of legalized gambling.
Well, one basic question here that I need to ask is, do tribes under the current compact in North Dakota, can they do some expansion? Can they make some alterations in terms of what they offer their guests without immediately conferring with the state?
So typically in tribal state compacts, including in North Dakota's, the compact itself lays out what games would be legal for the tribe to operate. And addition to that list of authorized games usually takes renegotiation of the compact. And there might be reasons why the state or the tribe doesn't want to renegotiate that compact, even to add something like sports betting.
But these tribes often contract with somebody who handles the gaming operation that might have nationwide experience doing that. So might they already be offering some aspects of this?
It depends on what the compact in that particular state authorizes. But you're exactly right that sports betting is a different animal. And that's one of the challenges, whether you're a tribe or you're a state, in thinking about legalizing sports betting. Do you have a sufficient regulatory structure in place to address the issues that will arise? So states like New Jersey and Nevada already know how to regulate gambling, and Nevada in particular knows how to regulate sports books. They have commissions, they have regulations, they have a funding structure to pay for that regulation in place. Other states and of course other tribes may be playing some catch up in terms of having a sufficient regulatory structure.
Catherine Rand is Dean of UND's Law School, Stephen Light, Dean of UND's College of Business and Public Administration, and they are co-directors of the Institute for the Study of Tribal Gaming Law and Policy. Catherine and Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Coming up next on Main Street, a commentary from Mark Trahant.
Now, Moses and I had won Goldie at the Tennessee State Fair the fall before. And he was so proud. You know, it only cost us $10 worth of freaking ping pong balls to win this fish that's worth less than a dollar on the open market.
Join us for stories of all the ways we say goodbye. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant taught journalism at the University of North Dakota until June, when he left to become the editor of Indian Country Today, a website that is a national news source for and about Native American people in North America, as well as First Nations people in Canada and Indigenous people worldwide. Mark is also the author of the blog Trahant Reports, where he comments about current affairs. And today, he reflects on Native Americans serving as judges.
A few weeks ago, I was interviewing the attorney and playwright Mary Catherine Nagel about her work. Her amazing plays merge Indian history and law with contemporary Native issues. There is often a character, an attorney, and a Native woman who argues before the Supreme Court. But I messed up. Instead, I asked her about a character, a young Native woman, who becomes the first Associate Justice serving on the Supreme Court. "Which play are you talking about?" Nagel responded. Then it hit me. None of her plays had that character. I was projecting beyond her fiction. "Now I need to write that play," Nagel quickly responded. "I think that would be an amazing play, to write a play where she's the first justice. Why not? Because then it begs the question, why not? Why not? I mean, you look at the whole history of this country and how integral tribal issues have been. Why wouldn't there have been one by now? Why not?" That is the question that should be asked whenever there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court, and for judicial openings in U.S. District Courts, U.S. Courts of Appeals, the Court of International Trade, as well as the Court of Claims, U.S. Customs Court, and the U.S. Court of Customs and Patent Appeals. If confirmed by the Senate, Judge Kavanaugh will be the 114th person to serve on the Supreme Court. The only active Native American on the bench is U.S. District Judge Diane Humptawa Hopi in Phoenix. She is one of three Native American judges in history. When she was confirmed by the U.S. Senate in 2014, there was a lot of optimism that more Native American judges would follow. As Attorney Chris Stern, Navajo, told Indian Country Today at the time, "Let's hope Diane's confirmation is just the start of a slew of Native American federal judges. There is still a massive lack of representation of Indian judges in the federal courts. A lack of representation remains. But one route to the bench starts with those who clerk for judges, especially those who serve the Supreme Court. Starting earlier this month, Toby Merritt Edwards Young, a Chickasaw tribal citizen, is doing just that, She is clerking for Associate Justice Neil Gorsuch. According to a news release from her tribe, Young is thought to be the first enrolled citizen of a Native American tribe to serve as a Supreme Court clerk. As she says, "I hope other Chickasaws read about my experience. They will recognize that nothing stops them from pursuing any dream that they have too. Somebody from where they are from is going to be working every day at the Supreme Court. And there's no reason there shouldn't be many more to come." Many more to come. Yes. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark's blog at trahantreports.com. Coming up on Main Street, Chuck Lura offers a natural North Dakota essay. Sue Balcom joins us to talk about farmers markets. And Ashley Thornburg and I will share our What's Happening calendar of things to do. Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. July 25th has been set as the day for the Minnesota Tax Department to roll out the process to collect sales tax from remote vendors. Dilworth State Representative Paul Marquardt serves on the House Tax Committee.
Yeah, it's basically what we would consider internet sales. And, you know, since 1992, states, even if they wanted to, were not able to collect or force these remote internet businesses to collect and then remit the sales tax that they sell to consumers. And that was a Supreme Court case. Now with the Wayfair case, the Supreme Court has said we're going to allow states to do that if they want.
Marquardt says when it comes to internet sales versus brick and mortar sales, the collection of sales tax helps even things out, and the revenue amount could be sizable for the state.
What they're looking at in Minnesota, and this isn't an exact number right now, but roughly around $150 million a year of increased revenue. That's kind of the ballpark figure right now. And of course, you know, in Minnesota, we talk about biennial budgets, and, you know, that would be $300 million. That's significant.
Marquardt says if the collection of sales tax does make any change, he thinks it would be likely in favor of the in-state brick-and-mortar retailers. Scientific advances in fields like gene editing and data sharing could transform food production in the next decade, but Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports that a group of scientists cautions such innovation may stall without public money.
That conclusion is part of a report from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. It lays out research that can make agriculture more resilient and sustainable. One example, engineering soil microbes so crops need less fertilizer. John Flouros is president of New Mexico State University and one of the report's authors. He says government funding has dwindled for that kind of science.
When we look at food and agriculture, it has really, over the years, lost its competitiveness, and we're now at the point where other countries may be able to outcompete.
But Congress appears ready to boost the research budget at the U.S. Department of Agriculture in the 2018 Farm Bill. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
And Grand Forks officials made the case for additional funding to complete the new water treatment plant at a regional meeting of the North Dakota Water Commission this week. City Administrator Todd Phelan says the $9.9 million request is based on the latest cost estimate for the plant at $149 million. The city submitted the numbers to the commission in hopes of being included in the governor's budget recommendations to the 2019 legislature. Phelan says the goal has always been a 50-50 cost share with the state. The commission will spend the next few months prioritizing funding. Phelan says the board understands the project, but there are more needs statewide than money available. The city has received $30 million in each of the last two legislative sessions for plant construction. The project is on schedule for a June 2020 completion date. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau, and he also writes about the flora and fauna that we find around us where we live in a series of essays we call Natural North Dakota. Today, Chuck Lura talks about sand and gravel.
We've all heard it. There are two seasons in North Dakota, winter and road construction. Of course, that's a tongue-in-cheek proclamation. But however you define the road construction season, one thing's certain. Gravel and sand pits are going to be busy places. Many of us see this activity, but I suspect that few of us have given much thought as to how these sand and gravel pits were formed. Sand and gravel deposits are mainly found in the glaciated regions of North Dakota, north and east of the Missouri River. South and west of the Missouri River, they're much less frequently encountered. In that part of the state, scoria and crushed rock largely replace sand and gravel. Glacial deposits may generally be considered mixtures of sand, silt, clay, gravel, and boulders in various amounts. A question one might ask is, why are these deposits mainly sand and gravel with little silt or clay? In a word, the answer is water. Sand or gravel pits are generally deposits formed in association with shorelines, for example, beach deposits, or associated with rivers and streams, for example, sandbars and gravel bars, oftentimes associated with melting glaciers at the end of the last ice age. Many sand and gravel deposits are associated with the shorelines of glacial lakes, such as Glacial Lake Souris in north-central North Dakota, Glacial Lake Minnewaukan in the Devil's Lake area, and of course Glacial Lake Agassiz along the eastern border of North Dakota and adjacent Minnesota. It's worth noting that the beach deposits on the Minnesota side of Glacial Lake Agassiz generally are much more pronounced than that on the North Dakota side. That's because the prevailing winds out of the west resulted in increased wave action on the downwind side, depositing coarser materials and also flushing out the finer silts and clays. Other sand and gravel deposits were also formed in association with meltwater channels and rivers towards the end of the last ice age. Some of this water flow was even in or on the glacier. Think of sand and gravel bars forming in rivers and how the energy of the flowage influences the size of the material. And as some of you know, the delta of the Cheyenne River, when it flowed into Glacial Lake Agassiz, is what we now know as the sand hills of Richland and Ransom counties. So the next time you pass a gravel or a sand pit, give some consideration to its formation. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and in our Bismarck studio, Sue Balcom with Root Cellars Farm near Mandan.
Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Well, I'm always happy to be here.
As we start to get into mid and into late July, it is a wonderful time to be getting fresh produce. Of course, if you're growing it, you're harvesting it out of your own gardens, but you can't grow everything. And then you head to the farmers market,
which are everywhere now.
Yeah.
They are everywhere. They're growing exponentially every year as more young people are coming back to the state and they want to farm. But they don't have land because they didn't inherit it, or they couldn't go to a bank really and say, hey, you know, can you lend me money to buy a farm? Because most conventional farming costs so much money that you just can't get into it. So they come and they grow vegetables and they have to sell them somewhere, and usually it's at farmers markets. And so you will see farmers markets popping up all over here in the next couple weeks.
And the interesting thing to me is that the different people who are vending at these farmers markets are, you know, often offering something I have not seen before. They want to be, you know, distinguish themselves from somebody else who's right in the booth next to them.
Right. So we've got people that are experimenting, like we had talked about earlier this year, microgreens, and then we talked about garlic scapes and stuff. But one of the most amazing things about shopping at a farmer's market for things that are different are a lot of us are growing heirloom variety vegetables. Mm-hmm. And these are open pollinated and indeterminate varieties that maybe were very popular back in the day but have kind of disappeared. We're making a resurgence, and we're also growing and saving seeds so that we can spread some of this wonderful tasting product around the countryside. There was a huge article in National Geographic with a diagram. We've lost hundreds and hundreds of varieties of vegetables because people just started breeding them for traveling, packing, consistent size and processing. And so when you go to the farmer's market, you are going to taste some of the best real flavors of tomatoes and carrots and, you know, peppers that when you cut into them squirt you in the eye because they're so juicy.
I have noticed that the fresher you can get your hands on the produce, the better tasting it is. Is there reason to believe, too, that they might be healthier? I mean, I've heard when you breed for sort of consistency and transportation, you might be breeding out some of the health benefits.
Right. And don't send anybody after me for saying this, but you guys got to know that they pick a lot of this stuff before it's actually ripe.
Tomatoes especially.
Tomatoes especially. And then they actually gas tomatoes to make them red before they put them on the store shelves. So that to me is kind of like not natural. I know it's necessary, but if you want to treat yourself, you've just got to go try it. Like a black crim. Those are my absolute favorite tomatoes in the whole world. They taste like the ones my mom grew when I was a child. Mm. They are so fabulous.
I'm partial to the Cherokee Purples myself.
Oh, yes. That's another one of those varieties, too. And I remember the first time I gave my brother some of those tomato plants, and I said, you've got to try these tomatoes. They're fantastic. And then in December, I asked him how he liked them, and he's like, they never got ripe. And I threw them all away, and I'm like, oh, no, they have black shoulders on purpose. You weren't supposed to throw them away. So we have to once again educate people that not all tomatoes are round and red, and they aren't all – not all carrots are orange. I mean, you can get purple ones and yellow ones. You could get purple beans, and things are seasonal. So when they're there at the market, don't hesitate. Get your stuff right away. It lasts longer in the refrigerator because it's not been shipped or picked, you know, 2 weeks before it got to market. So when you put your peppers and tomatoes in your refrigerator drawer, they will last a good 7 to 10 days and still be really phenomenal.
And early in the season, you know, a green tomato can be fried.
Oh, yes. I saw that movie. but, you know, another good reason is, you know, there are arguments against whether we're a little more environmentally sound practices on smaller farms. But one of the things that you're doing is you're supporting the family farm. These young people that are coming back to this state are coming back here to raise their children in North Dakota because they have fond memories of how we are here. You know, living the rural life is like a dream to me because that's how I grew up. You know, we ran through fields and we inspected bugs and we turned over dung and we saw dung beetles under there. And they're kind of gold and shiny. So if you've never done it, I would say go for it.
Well, I'll take your word for it.
Okay. And like you said, Doug, that you will find some real variety at farmers markets. All of us are growing different varieties of watermelon, different kinds of radishes. You might find some mushrooms. You'll find artisan breads there. Some people I know are harvesting nettles and purslane, which grow like mad where you never want them to. So you're actually eating some edible weeds, but they're only weeds if you don't want them to grow in your garden. So...
Well, let's talk about community at the farmers market, because I would go to a grocery store and I would go to great lengths to avoid eye contact with another human being. But I would go to a farmers market and I wouldn't hesitate to talk to a perfect stranger and say, oh, what is that? And not just the vendors, but even somebody who is shopping. And there's just, I don't know, there's more connection.
There is connection, and there's connection to people as well as connection to food. When you're strolling around, you're out in the sunshine, you really should kind of like tell people how European you feel, because that's how they go to market. They don't go to the market and stock up for a month. They go out there and they make it an adventure almost. Like you can sample things and you can ask questions. I don't know a single farmer that isn't willing to tell you how they grow something, where they grow something, you know, what they're going to try next year. Or in the case of recent or not so recent bad weather, the devastation that comes from being a farmer. You know, there's a little heartbreak mixed in there with all that joy sometimes, too. And they're always willing to tell you about that.
Well, the other thing about this is that you might spend a little bit more at a farmer's market, but you're getting produce that was probably picked that day, hasn't been on a truck for a week, hasn't been through some other process, and is likely going to taste a whole lot better.
Absolutely. And the taste, to me, is a big thing. And then, of course, there's all these great recipes because most of the people who grow food are foodies. And
yes.
So we got these ways for you to add a little spice to your life. And then again, there's that nutritious element there when you have soil, and a lot of people are chemical free. And so you've got lots of health benefits from eating more fruits and vegetables. And, you know, when you're there with the farmers and you're picking these vegetables out yourself, you know, you get to touch them first and you can smell them. And, you know, so you're engaging with your food, which is a really important part of all of this also.
And enjoying, you know, community, as Ashley mentioned, and you're outdoors and, well, you're enjoying yourself.
Right. And and summers are so short in North Dakota. The more time we can spend outside, the better we are. And the price, as far as the prices of things go, you know, there's very little waste when you're bringing home something that's that fresh, because you're usually going to eat it right away. It's not going to like sit in your refrigerator and then you forget about it because you've been so engaged with your food. You're like, oh, I can't wait to go home. And we're going to have this big salad and this big steak and this fancy bread. And there's also other things popping up at farmers market in addition, or complementary to vegetables, and, you know, things like cheeses and
preserves.
Yeah. Yep, preserves. You can get good jams and jellies. I make watermelon pickles. I have a tendency to do a lot of the things that I grew up with. So I get these little old ladies. Oh, and one of these days, someone's going to call me a little old lady, and I'm going to regret saying this. But they'll come by, and they'll pick up a jar, and they'll look at it, and they'll go, oh, you forgot the piece of celery in here. Nope, it's in there. And they'll tip it upside down. Oh, you did a pretty good job here. This is a really nice looking preserve. Like, I didn't think this was a 4-H competition here. Like, either you want them or you don't, okay?
All right. Well, with that advice, we'll bid adieu to Sue Balcom with the Root Cellars Farm near Mandan. Thanks for being with us.
Until next time, thank you guys both.
More Main Street in a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Great River Energy, powering what's possible by using new technologies to operate some of the most efficient power plants in North Dakota, helping to meet the energy needs of member consumers through reliable and affordable electricity and sound environmental stewardship.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, every Thursday, Ashley Thornburg and I ask that question. Usually, Ashley is with me here in the studio in Fargo, but today she's in our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Ashley.
Hello. Boy, I can't tell you how weird this feels to not be able to see you.
Well, what's happening?
Well, how about this one? Concerts in the Garden, Francis Cone. This is coming up Tuesday the 24th in Grand Forks at the North Dakota Museum of Art. Bring your own lawn chair or blanket, and better yet, bring a friend and enjoy some great music in the museum's sculpture garden. This is a casual outdoor event. Francis happens to be a Nashville-based soulful indie pop band that has been praised for compelling emotional live shows. So come check out Francis Cone this Tuesday, the 24th in Grand Forks at the North Dakota Museum of Art at 6 o'clock, and it's just $12.
The Badlands Chautauqua Gathering of TRs, that's Teddy Roosevelt's, is Friday through Sunday at Medora, and it's throughout that wonderful cowboy town. This year, Medora will be host to at least 13 Theodore Roosevelt reprisers, as they're called, as they converge on Teddy's beloved cowtown. They'll each bring their own unique interpretation of Roosevelt, yet they all share the same enthusiasm and love for the 26th president. The weekend events are slated to be full of history, entertainment, and education for the whole family. Most are free.
This three-day event is full of fun with a variety of classes, shows, and living history programs, plus Teddy Roosevelt games, socials, and performances all weekend. Again, the hours are various around Medora. The cost depends, but it's Friday through Sunday at Medora.
And Samuel Sprinsonatic, the Bismarck-based filmmaker, has a lovely film about last year's gathering, so you can check that out on his website, too. The River Arts Fishing Clinic this Tuesday, the 24th, in Moorhead at Memorial Park. You want to reel in a big one? Well, this event helps you, sort of learn some of the basics of fishing, from casting to knot tying to fish identification and more. If you are 15 and younger, you don't even need a fishing license for this event. 5:30 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, the 24th, in Moorhead at Memorial Park, and it's free.
Family Astronomy Nights, Friday in East Grand Forks at the East Grand Forks Heritage Village. Join the Northern Sky Astronomical Society once a month at Heritage Village for a night of learning about the night sky and taking in beautiful sights of the moon, planets, stars, and more. The event kicks off at 9 p.m. with an astronomy presentation in the Amundsen Classroom that's located right next to the Railroad Museum in the East Grand Forks Heritage Village. Observing is anticipated to begin sometime around 10 p.m., and after the presentation concludes, weather permitting, telescopes will be set up for everyone to look through. But if you have a telescope of your own, feel free to bring it along. Again, it starts at 9 at the East Grand Forks Heritage Village. The Family Astronomy Nights are free.
All right, here's a Jamestown event that sounds really fun, and donations go to a good cause, the Prairie Paws Rescue Splash and Dash Dog Wash, this Saturday, the 21st, in Jamestown. And you can bring your dog in for a bath, get a nail trim, and while your dog is getting cleaned up, you can eat a hot dog and get a drink there for a free will donation. This is a fundraiser, and the money goes to helping pets who need a little bit of medical care before they get adopted into their forever families. This is in Jamestown at R.M. Stout, the Prairie Paws Rescue Splash and Dash Dog Wash, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The cost is whatever your little heart desires as a suggested donation.
Capital Shakespeare presents Richard III tonight through Sunday in Bismarck at the Capitol grounds. One of Shakespeare's arch-villains ravages the English throne with his lust for power. In Capital Shakespeare's modern production of Richard III, jealous and deformed, the monarch's younger brother Richard, Duke of Gloucester, launches a brutal plan to become king at all costs and to vindicate a life in which no creature ever loved me, right out of the play. Performances of this famous tragedy take place in the outdoor Prairie Amphitheater south of the North Dakota Heritage Center. The space accommodates lawn chair and blanket seating. The show starts at 7 o'clock. It's free. Donations are welcome. Again, tonight through Sunday, Capital Shakespeare presents Richard III.
There's a Bob Ross paint and wine night. So many Bob Ross fans out there. And so come and celebrate Bob Ross Saturday the 21st in Williston at the James Memorial Arts Center. Go through his painting style, happy little tree, turn everything into a little tree, wear your favorite Bob Ross shirt, and please, anyone who's got some comparable Bob Ross hair or a wig or what have you, wear it to this event, because you are encouraged to dress up as the beloved Bob Ross, and you may even win a prize. This is the Bob Ross Paint and Wine Night, Saturday, July 21st in Williston at the James Memorial Art Center. The cost is $50. It is a fundraiser, and you do have to be 21 and up to attend.
All right, free painting demonstration with Buck Paulson is Saturday in Fargo at the Prairie Public Downtown Fargo Studio. You'll get some tips from a pro. Artist and educator Buck Paulson will be in Prairie Public's downtown studio on Saturday at 6 p.m. to greet you and demonstrate some of his painting techniques. Stop by for refreshments and painting inspiration. The event is free. No registration is required. Again, it's Saturday at 6 o'clock. Come on down.
All right, my pick of the week is also a Prairie Public event and a StoryCorps event tonight at 6:30 at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. Check out what StoryCorps is doing here, clips, not just nationally, but more importantly, locally, what North Dakota voices are saying. It gets going at 6:30 at the Heritage Center.
And mine is the Downtown Fargo Street Fair. It got a wet start. It runs through Saturday. It's from Broadway downtown from
3rd Avenue North, the annual Downtown Fargo Street Fair of Arts, Crafts, and Food brings hundreds of vendors to the city center for one of Fargo's biggest events of the year and North Dakota's biggest free outdoor event. It runs today and Friday from 10 a.m. till 9 p.m., Saturday from 10 to 5, and that's what's happening.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 19th. Meriwether Lewis, William Clark, and the Corps of Discovery weren't the only outsiders to mingle with the Mandans on the Upper Missouri River in what is now North Dakota. Even before the Corps returned downriver in the summer of 1806, another expedition paid the Mandans a visit. Alexander Henry was employed by the Northwest Company, and he sought out the Mandans to acquire horses. He and two men left the trading post on the Red River at Pembina and traveled by horseback on muddy trails in the region of the Assiniboine and Mouse Rivers. They stopped at a Northwest Company trading post near the Mouse River, then headed south. In the party was Hugh McCracken, a free trader that Lewis and Clark met among the Mandans in 1804. Around 4 o'clock in the afternoon on this date in 1806, Henry's party arrived at the Missouri Riverbank across from the mouth of the Knife River near the Mandan villages. The expedition rode 5 miles downriver to a village where they came upon several Mandan women hoeing corn. There was also one well-armed man. He shook hands with the members of the expedition and invited them into the village. Henry met Chief Black Cat, who had also met Lewis and Clark. The Mandans accommodated Henry's men and tended their horses. They were served boiled corn and beans and also boiled dried meat, which few of the men could stomach. Black Cat showed them a flag that Lewis and Clark had given him, and he flew it over Henry's hut during the expedition's stay. Like Lewis and Clark, Henry kept a journal and described the Mandans' way of life and his interactions with them, including their gardens, their bull boats, and a corn mill given to them by Lewis and Clark, though the Mandans used it as a source of iron to barb their arrows. Henry also met another character of the Corps of Discovery, René Jusam. He had helped translate the Mandan language for the Corps. Jusam was also the person who recommended that Sacagawea ingest a crushed rattlesnake's rattle to hasten childbirth. Henry's party left after 9 days, missing Lewis and Clark on their return trip by about 2.5 weeks. Henry's expedition returned north with the sought-after horses, though some ended up lost or stolen. After that, the Northwest Company withdrew from Mandan trading. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
U.S. intelligence agencies agree that the 2016 presidential election was compromised, from hacking and leaking emails to spreading misinformation.
These actions are persistent, they're pervasive, and they are meant to undermine America's democracy on a daily basis.
With midterm elections just 4 months away, what's being done to stop the threat on the next morning edition?
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, Felicia Johnson is a youth mentor and mental health advocate, and in a trilogy of books, she uses fiction to examine the complexities of borderline personality disorder, bipolar disorder, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. She'll join us to discuss these conditions on Friday. And for this week's Friday News Brief, we'll bring in Eric Whitney, news director for Montana Public Radio. He'll update us on the headlines from our neighbors to the west. Madeline will also be back with another movie review. On Friday, he'll tell us about Hearts Beat Loud. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.